Heroes and Heroism, The Law of the Land. Those reports and more next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. Ralph Waldo Emerson called him representative man, the individual notable for personal courage, self-reliance, independence of spirit. Another term for people with those qualities is hero, and that word sounds rather out of fashion nowadays. One scholar at the National Humanities Center is looking at the topic of heroes and heroism from the historical standpoint in a book that he's writing about Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, the early American figures of myth and legend. Here's Michael LaFaro, a professor from the University of Tennessee.
The idea of a representative man is very key to the idea of a hero. A representative man, of course, could be real, a character who is actual and does exist, or a character in fiction, but is usually someone who does represent the best, the ideals of a particular nation or people in a particular time and place. The ideal in America seems to have circulated around, first of all, the key ideas of freedom, independence, individuality, and the hero is usually someone who, in a time of crisis, can help us best preserve these cherished ideals. I think that might be the simplest way of getting at it.
Professor LaFaro, what's the connection between fact and fancy in these public conceptions of heroes?
I believe that most of our heroes have been to some degree associated with the frontier. We're a nation that is founded on the principle of a frontier. The first people who came here found a frontier, and we've always had one frontier or another, even if we've had to construct them and make them mental or spiritual frontiers. You start with Captain John Smith, the first walk into the woods at Jamestown. And why did Kennedy call his program the New Frontier? And what is the high point of that? The first walk on the moon. So you can tie even the walks together. They are explorations.
Does this mean that American heroes, as you are studying them, always have something to do with exploration in either a geographical sense or a psychological sense?
It stems from the fact that we have a very different concept than Europeans of what a frontier is. Because of our history, what I just mentioned, that we always were faced with this forest primeval, literally, we don't regard a frontier necessarily as a European would, which is essentially as a boundary or a border. It just delineates political or geographical areas.
To an American, this is something not necessarily to move up to and live with. It's something to move beyond.
Exactly. For Americans, frontiers have essentially been seen as a challenge from the very beginning. It's something that you have to penetrate, investigate, and eventually conquer, or be killed by, because there always is an element of danger with the frontier that I think, again, supports the idea of the heroic. I think, for example, one of the best things about Davy Crockett is that he does tie together a lot of the threads that seem to permeate the frontier, the hero, and other various allied concepts that I've really just spun out in this little conversation today. Crockett himself is the representative Democrat with a little D, the champion of the common man. He was called a congressman from the cane, and he battled a couple of congressmen because that was a derogatory statement. They were saying he was from a cane brake. Literally, he was born in the swamps, etc., and he didn't take that too kindly, so he threatened a couple of them with bodily harm until they took back their varying insulting remark. But then he began to like it, and even used it a couple of occasions himself, calling himself the congressman from the cane. So reversing the derogatory role and putting it to political advantage. He also applauded his lack of education and his lack of legal training. He had nothing He felt to corrupt him. It was the innocent in the political quagmire, untainted by what literally surrounded him. He does follow the rags-to-riches story. He caught the imagination of the American people vividly in the 1820s as congressman and as literal folk hero, and continued straight through the 1950s with the Walt Disney movies. And he does fulfill all the requirements for a hero. If we think of the ancient heroes, religious, epic heroes, whatever, all of them, for example, had to do noble deeds. Crockett did noble deeds. All of them, well, not all of them, but many of them had these obscure beginnings and the rise to fame. There was always some hint of a divine guidance there. And indeed, Crockett hinted that at himself. He said oftentimes he didn't know exactly why, and the why and wherefore of a certain happening or occurrence or action that he took. But he always could follow his motto. And again, this is the essence of democracy. His motto was, be sure you're right, and then go ahead.
He even qualifies in the sense that he became a martyr. Isn't that true?
Very much so. That's one of the key things. In fact, Crockett, of course, died at the Alamo. A very noble death against overwhelming odds. And he's cut off in his prime. Boone, on the other hand, Boone lived till he was 86 and died of indigestion after he ate too many sweet potatoes, which was his favorite food. It's sort of hard to make an epic hero out of somebody dying at 86 of indigestion.
Do heroes act as cultural barometers? Did Crockett and Boone and or Boone act in this way? Is that how
I
you see them?
That's true to a high degree with Crockett, I think. It's very hard to pin Boone down. Boone really tends not to fit the pattern of cultural barometer because he was outside the historic patterns of the formation of the United States, much more so than Crockett. Crockett was really a part of that, where Boone kept trying to get away from it. He was moving away from civilization. Every time civilization clustered around him, which it tended to do because he was famous, he would get upset, move 50, 60, 200 miles further into the frontier, and settle down again so he wouldn't have that many people necessarily to deal with. But again, remember, it's not just getting away from the people. When the people come, the game disappear. And he was a very, very fine hunter and very fond of hunting. And when the game disappeared, it took his main means of livelihood. He didn't like farming. So he literally had to move when civilization caught up with him. But when he did, civilization said, well, there goes Daniel Boone. He's blazed another trail and followed right after and settled right around him because they figured he would protect them. He knew about the Indians, and so he'd look around. There'd be no game, more people. He'd have to move again. And he did this throughout his entire life, winding up in Missouri for the last 20 years of his life.
Professor LaFaro, do Americans have myths and heroes today?
Well, we do, but I think our definition of hero has changed a good deal. We have a great deal of retrospective hero creation right now because of normally martyrdom of popular figures in popular culture.
So the Kennedys and Martin Luther King.
Exactly. But for me, the heroic, at least in the older sense, which is the one I'm perhaps most interested in, there is a great deal of the leadership, the idealization of Camelot, the New Frontier program. All this really is after the fact. If you look at the current accounts of Kennedy's record, he was doing good things, but mainly the thing that strikes me most often is what great potential there was and how well he would probably do in a second term. He was not the hero then. He caught the fancy of the American people, his youth, vitality, the vigor, and he was a war hero, what I would call the old line image of the hero. But by and large, I think really his elevation has been a phenomenon that is created after his death. Indeed, I'm very hard pressed to say that we have a real hero today.
Michael LaFaro is professor of American Studies at the University of Tennessee and a scholar at the National Humanities Center. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings. Many commentators and social critics today argue that the future belongs almost exclusively to science and technology. But that isn't necessarily the case, according to Claire Gaudioni, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a teacher of foreign languages at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Gaudioni argues for what she terms a Socratic balance between practical advantages and moral well-being in the education of American young people.
Well, I think there are probably several issues here. First will be an attitude change. For people who have young children, we need to stop thinking that they're good in one thing and not good in the other. That is, if a child is good in reading and art, he's going to be a bad mathematician, or if she's excellent in mathematics, she's going to be a bad English student or won't be interested in history. We need to assume a dual capacity in children, and then we need to orient their activities so that they have opportunities to develop strengths in both directions. This will involve a reorientation of our own thinking. We need to be sure that our own fields, whatever they happen to be, whether they be in the science and technology, engineering sorts of specialties, or whether they be in more humanistically oriented fields, we need to be sure that our own lives reflect this dual capacity. In a sense, I guess we have to examine our own lives, decide what our own values are. Then I think we need to anticipate and encourage change in the educational sector. Right now there's a good deal of what I would consider to be precipitously early specialization in colleges and in even some cases in high schools. Students need to be exposed to the broad range of human knowledge throughout their careers, and I would call for a much more, I would certainly want to see us return to a more balanced curriculum than we have in many institutions right now. And finally, in work opportunities, we need to broaden our own exposure to other fields. And this is being done. There are areas, of course, Aspen has been doing it for a while, combining professionals in the sciences with professionals in humanities and giving them opportunities to exchange their experiences and their information. We need, in a sense, to shrug off our notions of mastery as adults. And often these feelings that we have to be excellent stop us from trying new fields. We need to expose ourselves, if we're in the science and technology area, to poets and historians in our extracurricular reading. And of course the reverse should be equally true, so that we find ourselves more broadly educated since our own formal education is finished. We try to have an impact on the curriculum to make sure that the students who are coming through the educational system are more broadly educated, and in our own homes to make sure that our children have opportunities to perceive themselves as strong in both domains.
Professor Claire Gaudioni teaches foreign languages and literature at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's a scholar at the National Humanities Center. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. How do Americans view the laws of the land? Where do those views come from? The answers to those questions are part of a study by one scholar at the National Humanities Center. Professor Harold Berman, who teaches law at Harvard University, is writing a book about the impact of political turmoil, such as the French Revolution of 1789, on modern democracies, such as the American Republic.
Well, we do look at law, as you say, as a monolith or as something ad hoc or arbitrary, or just something that was made by somebody in power or authority. This is what I call the crisis of the Western legal tradition. This is why I'm studying this history, to retrace the steps by which we got to where we are.
Because of this perception?
Right. Uh-huh. In other words, it seems to me that ever since World War I, that the Western legal tradition has been in trouble because it has seemed less and less of a tradition and more arbitrary, the law, that is. I think even 50 or 60 years ago, if you asked a person in America or anywhere in Europe, you know, where does the law come from? What is the law that you're studying? Or where does it come from? What's it all about? People would have said, well, I suppose it comes from the Bible, or it comes from Magna Carta or English history, or it's part of the order of the universe. There has to be law, you know. People have to have law because they couldn't regulate their relations without it. We have to have some concept of right, some concept of rights. And they would have given sort of lofty, it would have been some talk like that, you see. Now, if you ask people today, hey, where does law come from, you know, what is law, they're going to say it comes from some damn legislators out there in Washington or somewhere else. I mean, people, I think, have lost or are losing, or at least there's a danger that we are losing, or may lose, this sense of any tradition. It's pretty arbitrary. It's people in power who are trying to get their will effectuated. Mm-hmm. Well, there always have been some philosophers who've believed that at all times, but I think now the great majority of people have come to have this very skeptical, even cynical view of the law, which is exactly in the point of my study, to try to retrace the steps by which we got to the law we have, and to show that its roots have been really cut away, and that we're going to have to do something now, either to develop new foundations, if you like, or to transplant, or to replant, or to recreate a new legal tradition. Now, if you go to the French Revolution, it's an example of a very nihilistic, iconoclastic, cynical view of the existing law. In 1789, when the French Revolution broke out, the law was seen to be full of arbitrariness, prejudice. People, they were going to overthrow this legal system. And they had a lot of utopian ideas as to whether they were going to go back to nature. Rousseau said, we're going to go to a kind of a philosophy of justice without law. Every revolution in the West has preached this sort of apocalyptic vision of a new heaven and a new earth in which there is no law, everybody's a brother, and so forth. But after things settled down, and after terrible catastrophe, out of the French Revolution came the Napoleonic Codes. And this was a great revision of the law, which founded a whole new legal era and a legal system, and developed the tradition. Now, these codes actually built on the earlier pre-revolutionary law. In the first place, they've made systematic codes. Second place, they established legislative supremacy as against judicial. They were democratic. They were supposed to respond to public opinion. Also, they glorified private property, freedom of contract, in ways that had never been done before. And this created a whole new era. And then these codifications spread all over Europe. Now, in America and in England, we accepted a lot of the fruits and results of the Napoleonic and the French codification movement without actually adopting their system. We revised our own system. Of course, the American Revolution had a lot of democracy in it, and not only the old English traditions, which were more aristocratic. Well, it's wrong to focus just on the one word code, or just the one technique of codification. A part of it was legislative supremacy. Law should respond to public opinion, the legislature should be free to change the law. And the judges should do just exactly what the legislature says. Well, there are a whole lot of new ideas which are no longer have the vitality in the 20th century that they had in the 19th. In the United States, we've neglected some very critical aspects of our history in which the law is deeply involved. In the United States in the early 1800s, we had a great debate and a great struggle over the question of whether we would continue to operate under the English common law. And Jefferson and others, many others, asked why should we have this common law? Why did we have a revolution? It was just to get away from this old privileged aristocracy, these old traditions. As one fiery Irishman named William Sampson said, who defended people in court on this ground, are we to be governed forever by the laws of the Picts and the Scots and the Druids, you see? I mean, why do we have to these terrible laws? We got from England our law of conspiracy. Workers were prosecuted in 1806 in Philadelphia, and for in many cases thereafter until the 1840s, for forming labor unions, because these labor unions were said to be conspiracies, illegal in and of themselves under the old English law of conspiracy. Well, there was quite a struggle over this, and it had to do with the identity of the nation. But so that I see the struggle in America in the early 19th century over what kind of law we should have, and the courts faced this question absolutely. You know, they had to decide, and they didn't decide simply, we'll take the old English law. They said, we'll take the old English law insofar as it's applicable to our new conditions. And they began to fool around with it in ways which were very different from the ways that the English were treating it. So I see this whole struggle in the United States in the early 1800s in the law field and a lot of our politics as a struggle between ideas associated with the English Revolution of the 17th century and ideas associated with the French Revolution of the 18th century. And in a way, American history seems to me to represent a conflict between a kind of a traditional, if you like, aristocratic conception, going back to Parliament and Magna Carta and robed judges, you know, who were elected for life, appointed for life, and other types of monarchical and aristocratic traditions in our, and on the other hand, these more democratic, more rational, we have this sort of conflict between the ideas which I associate with these two revolutions, which conflict between Jeffersonians and Hamiltonians, if you like. In one form or another, it goes right up through to the present day.
Harold Berman is professor of law at Harvard University and a scholar at the National Humanities Center. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. One of the enduring paradoxes which fascinates and challenges believers and non-believers alike is the problem of being in the world but not of it. The 17th century English poet and churchman John Donne is no exception. Here's Professor John Wall of North Carolina State University at Raleigh and a scholar at the National Humanities Center.
The traditional image of John Donne's life is of an early period in which he was rakish and a libertine, and a later period in which he was the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, an Anglican priest, and one of the most important of the early 17th century Anglican clergy.
But it's far more complex than that.
That portrait comes to us from the later 17th century, in which, in the works of Isaac Walton, whose life of Donne, which is our basic record for knowing about Donne's career, Walton wanted to make Donne out to be a modern St. Augustine, and he borrowed the pattern of Augustine's life as Augustine presented in the Confessions, an early life of error, an early life of libertine living, a moment of conversion, and then the more important part, the later life, as Christian and as ultimately as one of the Christian bishops of North Africa. Donne's life gives us evidence to support that argument. The difficulty is that I don't think there's the evidence to say. I think we know that at the same time that Donne was writing this poetry, much of which is very erotic, he was also very involved as a result of his rigorous Catholic childhood education. He was concerned with religious questions. He was concerned with the thinking through the whole relationship in his world between the established Church of England on the one hand and its Roman Catholic counterpart in Europe. He was forced, by virtue of the fact that he grew up in a Catholic family, some of his relatives were in fact imprisoned and died for the faith, to take these issues seriously. Now, both of these elements are there together. It may in fact be a consequence of our own world that we look for an either-or kind of answer. Dunn, for example, is capable at the same time of writing the libertine poetry, of writing poetry which celebrates fidelity and constancy in love. One of the most famous is a poem called A Valediction for Bidding Morning, in which he says that the situation is that the speaker of the poem is leaving the lady, and he says, let's don't make a big fuss out of leaving. Ordinary lovers would make a fuss about it. We are extraordinary lovers. We by a love so much refined that ourselves know not what it is, enter assured of the mind, care less eyes, lips, and hands to miss. Our two souls, therefore, which are one, though I must go, endure not yet a breach, but an expansion, like gold to airy thinness beat. If they be two, they are two, so as stiff twin compasses are two. Thy soul, the fixed foot, makes no show to move, but doth if the other do. And though it on the center sit, yet when the other far doth roam, it leans and hearkens after it, and grows erect as that comes home. Such wilt thou be to me, who must like the other foot obliquely run. Thy firmness makes my circle just, and makes me end where I begun. Now this is not a libertine lover. This is someone who's proclaiming to the lady that their relationship is such that it will maintain them in constancy and fidelity and sustain them in their separation until they can be together again. The difficulty is that we have that poem, and we also have a poem like Dunn's Elegy 19, which is one that I enjoy using in classes with students in America, because it reveals something about how our country was viewed by the English early in the period of American colonization as a new place, a place that is wide open and full of possibilities.
The Virgin Land.
The Virgin Land. In this particular poem, to his mistress going to bed, the speaker is lying in bed, and he's urging his mistress to disrobe and join him in bed, and he says, tells her something about what will happen when she comes to bed. He says, license my roving hands and let them go before, behind, between, above, below. Oh, my America, my newfound land, my kingdom safeliest when with one man manned, my mine of precious stones, my empery, how blessed am I in this discovering thee. Now, I think what it seems to me the best position about Dunn is that Dunn is the kind of person capable of entertaining all these thoughts. He's a person whose personality is rich enough to create all of these speakers, and to, in at least for the course of the poem, to mean them. Later on, after he married Anne Moore, he was faced with a real crisis in any kind of secular career. A career in the church as a priest was open to him, and he took it again, not without some kind of mixture of a profound sense of vocation and a profound sense of necessity. This is a channel through which to make sure that his family is taken care of, that he's taken care of, that he can have a career. And he's darn good at it.
John Wall is professor of English at North Carolina State University and a scholar at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, inviting you to join me for Soundings. Topics this week include heroes and heroism in American culture, technology and social values, and a profile of the English poet John Donne. I hope you'll be listening this week for Soundings.